You're listening to the What Do You Actually Do podcast. Each week, we want to bring you an inspiring interview, a useful tip, or encouraging message to help you find your place in the professional world. Hello and welcome to this episode of What Do You Actually Do. My name's Kate Morris, and I'll be your host today. In today's episode, we'll be talking about working in journalism and writing. Today, we're joined by Sam Bright, who's the UK Deputy Editor of DSMORG, investigative journalist and writer, who's been published with the BBC, New York Times, The Big Issue, New Statesman, and authored books on Bullingdon Club and Fortress London. So Sam, that's a lot of stuff. What do you actually do?
I write a lot, which is, yeah, the top line, really. But yeah, a whole range of things, really. I found that breaking into the media, you've got to sort of have quite a diverse skill set. And yeah, over the past 10 years or so, I guess I've done a number of things. As you say, I've worked for the BBC, so a fair amount of broadcasting. But now my day-to-day job really focuses on investigative journalism, so finding stuff out that bad actors don't want you to know about. Yeah, and also editing articles and managing a team of journalists at DSMORG. I'm sure my next job will take me into something new entirely.
So it's something, it sounds like then, it's the type of career where you're not staying in one lane. You are learning new skills, picking up different types of roles and evolving as you go along.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, obviously I can only speak to my experience, but I did find that increasingly in journalism, and certainly if any of your listeners are sort of dabbling in this and taking their first steps and looking at the opportunities out there, journalism is a field that is constantly evolving, is constantly changing. There are new outlets springing up all the time. Unfortunately, there are also other outlets laying staff off. So to actually stay in one position for any amount of time is tricky at the minute. I know plenty of people who started with me at the BBC after I graduated. You know, I did BBC work experience. And I know people who started out at that time with me, who stayed at the BBC for that amount of time for sure, and people who stay at big publications for a while. But I'd say typically what tends to happen when you break into the industry now is that you do get a range of sort of project work, of freelance gigs that you can do for either an article, you know, just a single article, or for 3 or 6 months at a time. And then you have to move on quite quickly to something else and gain a portfolio of work that then can cement you in the industry and hopefully get you a full-time position if that's, you know, if that's the route that you choose.
In your current role then, what's a typical day for you? Do you work in an office? Are you fully remote? Do you come up with an idea or something to investigate and you travel to different countries looking into it? How does it work?
So a range of different things. I have to say that I've only just started at DSMORG, so I'm still very much getting my feet under the table and figuring it out myself. But from what I know during these early stages, we work in an office 1 day a week on a Monday. So that's in central London, in sort of flexible office working space. We rent a room out in there. And then the other 4 days a week, we all work from home. And DSMORG's an international operation. So it was started across the Atlantic in North America. And we've got editors in the United States, in Canada, and in the UK, and freelancers, you know, across all those jurisdictions and in the EU. So it's very much, you know, working across different time zones. You know, we have a global editors call, where, you know, everybody puts their heads together from the various different parts of the world and tries to coordinate what they're doing. In terms of me, you know, the days are quite varied, actually. So one day I could be editing an article that one of our staff writers has prepared, has researched. And you go through various different stages of that editing process. You know, it can be the first look at a draft of an article where you really get into the nuts and bolts of whether the story stands up, whether the facts are right. And then later down the line, you know, you've really got to get into how this is written and whether we're conveying what we're trying to say in the clearest way. We pitch to mainstream media partners as well. That can be involved in the editing process, you know, approaching the Times or the Guardian, etc., and asking if they'd like to partner on a story. I write myself, so if I see an idea, you know, I'll pitch it to my editor and she'll say yay or nay. And if it's a yay, then I'll crack on and write that myself, you know. And then there's various different admin bits, you know, HR related, make sure that making sure that everyone's happy, that everyone's, you know, singing off the same hymn sheet, and the project work that sort of goes on in the background, the long-term investigations, that they're progressing well, and making sure that people have time to check in and feedback their concerns.
I mean, I imagine if you're investigating something, that would be quite an immersive task, going into the real detail of something and really doing all your fact-checking. Is that quite a challenge then, to sort of have that really minute detail, immersive kind of thinking, but at the same time still be trying to do all that other stuff that you just mentioned?
Oh God, yeah, that is a real challenge, especially when your emails build up in the background while you're spending half a day or so, you know, looking into the various conflicts of interest regarding an oil firm, for example. I guess I'm fairly used to that, and it's about, as best as possible, compartmentalizing your time and trying not to get too overwhelmed or stressed by your sort of background tasks building up while you're researching something. But it can be easier said than done. A lot of investigative journalism involves digging into the detail of something because you've sniffed out a story, you've got a hunch as to whether something will pay off. And then you do your groundwork, you do 2 or 3 hours, you sink a load of time into it, and then it turns out that the story isn't quite what you think it was. And so you've had all that work build up in the background for nothing. That is a tricky thing, but you know, I'm someone who does really love sort of a lot of my work basically just involves online stalking. So anybody who's stalked anybody on a social media platform, my job is actually very, very similar to that. But instead of with people, although occasionally with people, I'm stalking sort of companies and their wrongdoing. So I think that probably puts it into perspective a bit better for people.
That situation then of doing a load of work and then there's no payoff, I'm guessing if you're employed and your editor team is supporting you to do that and you're getting paid to do it regardless, that's less painful than if you're freelance and you're trying to investigate to be and then be able to pitch that story to media outlets. Is that a sort of an issue within the industry?
Yeah, hugely. And yeah, I'd say that bigger publications, unfortunately, just because of the nature, and by bigger publications, I mean generally the newspapers, aren't really set up to support that form of investigative journalism, because you'll get paid pretty much a fixed amount by a lot of newspapers, regardless of how much time you've put into it. And the opportunities for negotiating are quite small. So yeah, that is a real problem. And as a result, all you get is, you know, reactive news pieces, clickbait, that's just bouncing off the latest item that's at the top of the news, rather than looking into systemic wrongdoing, corruption and, you know, malpractice, you know, both in politics and in business. So that's definitely a problem. You know, there are outlets out there, the sort of, you know, Desmog's one of them, but also the Bureau of Investigative Journalism and other generally grant-funded organisations, Open Democracy is good as well, that do try to foster investigative journalism, but unfortunately it's few and far between.
With your books that you've written then, was that a similar process in terms of you pitch the ideas to publishing houses and they kind of said, yeah, here's some cash, go off and do it? Or did you write the books kind of in your own time and then pitch them to publishing, or did you self-publish them?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So my first book is called Fortress London, Why We Need to Save the Country from Its Capital. I sort of had an idea for it while I was working at an organization for a publication down in London, and then I'd quit and I'd come back up north, and I was fuming about the role of London in our national life and the fact that it's so difficult to sustain employment down there if you come from a different region or, you know, you come from a disadvantaged background. And so I sort of wrote an initial idea down, sort of 5,000 words in rage after finishing that job because I had a bit of spare time. And then just, I guess, fortuitously, someone who I used to work with at the BBC, one of the editors, had been contacted by her commissioning editor who'd commissioned a book that she'd written previously. And he'd joined a new publishing house and was looking for Northern writers specifically to pitch ideas. And I'd obviously got one that I'd prepared earlier. with the pitch that I'd written. So I just chucked it in his direction, having had, you know, sort of a reference from this BBC editor saying, you know, look at Sam, it's worth looking at Sam's ideas. You know, he's a good writer. I can vouch for him. And that process, you know, that pitching process took a while. You know, it took a bit of pestering. I sent the initial draft and then it sort of went quiet for a while. And that can often be the case, not just with publishing, but with journalism as well. Editors are very busy and they struggle to get back to people promptly. I remember I was on the way back from Cornwall, driving back to London with my girlfriend, and we were listening to a podcast where two authors were chatting away about their books. And I had that moment where I was like, I would love to be in this position. And I've pitched an idea to a commissioned editor and I haven't bugged him in a while. And so the first thing that I do when I get back to London is that I'm going to pester him. It actually turns out that he loved the idea. He just hadn't had the time to respond to me. From then on, you know, he suggested some edits for me to do, and it evolved quite quickly into a stage where an offer was made. And then after that point, it's very much, you know, you've got to fit it in. You get to negotiate the amount of time that you're allowed to submit the book. I was given 12 months. And so the task was to fit the research and the writing around my work. And that involved a day a week of research at the weekends. And then I took 2 months off, a month of paid, a month of unpaid leave at the job that I was in, and to just bash the book out. Fortunately, it's alive and in the world.
That must be an amazing feeling to kind of actually have something tangible for all that hard work.
Yeah, it's weird because it is very much like a part of you. And I'd say that I recommend to everybody to write, because I think that writing for me is not always like, and it sounds sort of hopelessly profound, but it's not always the process of putting my ideas down on paper. I literally write in order to stimulate my thoughts. And that can be on anything. You know, for me, it's about ranting about, you know, the government, but, you know, that can be about, you know, your own, whatever you're experiencing in your own life. Yeah, I would really recommend it. And having that, which is basically, you know, hours and hours worth of me piling my thoughts and developing my thoughts on a particular topic into a project, and then for it to be something tangible is incredibly fulfilling.
So what was your starting point there? And where did your interest in investigative writing come from?
So within certain outlets, and particularly when I started at the BBC, you know, the BBC is one of the few, or at least it was when I was working there, was one of the few media outlets where it did give you the space to investigate things. And there was a demand for digging into interesting subjects. So yeah, I think I really developed my tools there. And then really it's been the process of getting my teeth into certain stories and having the opportunity to cover them, because there's a ton of work actually taking place, particularly in broadcasters, that doesn't get on air because there just isn't enough time to put those stories on air. And I actually left the BBC in 2019 and went to work in independent media, which I work in currently. And that's completely the opposite. You get a lot of scope to produce material, and you can become senior quite quickly. And so the skills that I developed as an investigative journalist at the BBC, which didn't always land me a story, I then managed to apply to sort of my new horizons in independent media, where you get a lot of opportunities to write quite frequently. And then along came the pandemic, and I was nosing around the contracts that the government had awarded for personal protective equipment, and basically found quite quickly that a lot was going wrong, and sort of staked my claim to that story and published, ended up publishing about 50 or more stories on procurement during the pandemic. So yeah, it's a constant process of, you know, you've got to develop your skills at the outset, but then actually being able to apply them in a meaningful way. As I say, that's quite tricky in the current media landscape, but I've been fortunate that I've been able to, and there's been a demand for the sort of stories that I've been doing over the past few years, and the subjects that I've been interested in, particularly wrongdoing at the highest levels of government. Lots of other people and lots of people who run media outlets have been interested in as well. So I've managed to do relatively well at it.
Thinking back to early days then, you set up an open platform political blog called backbench when you were a student. How did that impact on your career?
So that's probably the biggest factor in me becoming a journalist. Yeah, I owe it all to that decision I made in boredom between A-levels and university. Yeah, nerdy, bored decision. You know, most people would have, you know, I don't know, bought a new video game, but, you know, I didn't want to do that. And honestly, I had no idea how it would work. You know, I didn't have any backing to do it. I remember I commissioned a logo from a local designer in Huddersfield for like 50 quid or something. I built the site using free web design tools. You know, I had no idea how to code or anything like that. And then just set up a profile on Twitter for Backbench and just followed a load of people who looked like they were young and interested in politics. Yeah, and it just turned out that there was a demand, that there were lots of people like me who were sort of starting out in their journeys as young writers, as, you know, angry about various things, curious about various things, and wanted to put their name to online articles. And we sort of really reaped the rewards of that. You know, it was challenging to the same extent because I soon found, you know, within 6 months that we were getting, you know, one or two stories a day that we'd have to publish. And I hadn't built the infrastructure to sort of support the project. I was the only editor. So I had to, alongside university work and going to a new city and making new friends, I was, you know, trying to edit the articles, do the social media, you know, do any sort of like graphics that we wanted to put on social media, et cetera. And yeah, so it was a challenge, but it honed my ability to write well, and particularly the pressure of knowing that I was editing people's work who were, say, you know, studying PPE at Oxford and were in their third year, and I was in my first year of a completely different degree. I was quite acutely aware of needing to be respected in their eyes as someone who could write and could edit well. So that put a lot of pressure on me to develop my writing and my editing skills. And I think it showed initiative, I'd like to say. And I think having spoken to the person who recruited me for the BBC Work Experience scheme, it was the biggest factor in them picking me over the thousands of other candidates that they had to choose from. So it definitely set my career off on the right path.
I think when I talk to students who are interested in journalism, one of the really tricky things is getting work experience. So I think that's a really good idea that you had there, to just create your own experience, because you can get caught in that loop, can't you? Of like, how do you get experience without experience? Because you want to have something to impress potential employers, to sort of showcase your abilities. How do you do that if you don't have any experience already? So to do something for yourself is a really good solution to that problem.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it makes you stand out, because there are lots of people who get, and, you know, this isn't a slight on, you know, these work experience opportunities, because, you know, I went into that path as well eventually. But lots of people, you know, have had work experience at the BBC or the Times or wherever, you know, Channel 4, ITV. But actually setting up your own publication and developing the skills associated with that really jumps out to people, I think, because actually so few people do it.
Interestingly, it sounds like it's been good training for what you're doing now as well, that multitasking, that ability to edit, review, assess other people's work, do your own investigations and writing, but at the same time as managing doing your actual history degree, living your life, probably having a part-time job. Like, that's kind of that hustle, if you like. That's kind of, it sounds like at the start when you're saying what a typical day is now and having to balance all those different things, it's like, actually that probably was a really good training ground, as well as to give you an insight into, yeah, I can cope with this, because I think some people would find that absolutely overwhelming and stressful. So to know that you can do that and enjoy it, it was probably quite a useful experience in itself.
You know, thinking about it, what I was doing back then 10 years ago probably isn't that different to my job now. Just, you know, I'm getting paid to do it. Yeah, I'm very much like responding to pieces that come into me, editing them, like managing writers, writing stuff myself, you know, posting stuff on social media. Like, it's all very much swimming in the same pool. And yeah, it gave me a great grounding and great confidence to know that I can do it. And also, like I say, lots of the legacy media outlets and even the BBC now, you know, are suffering financially. But certainly for me, one of the opportunities that I found is in the new projects that are springing up. You know, I've worked for two startup media publications in the past like 4 years. And I think one of the main reasons they hired me, and also one of the main reasons why I knew I wanted to go into those positions, was because what I'd done at Backbench, and they knew I had a diverse skill set in terms of like building websites and managing a full diversity of roles and not just being pigeonholed to one. And I think, like I say, in a media landscape where opportunities can change quickly, you need to stay fleet-footed in many ways and have lots of strings to your bow. I mean, for example, I still think that I could go and do radio or TV again at some point should circumstances at the BBC change. And that's a nice sort of reassurance in many ways in an industry that isn't at the peak of its powers.
Yeah, I think you're right. Having that adaptability, it's actually important in so many different professions, but journalism itself is such an interesting one with the transition that it's going through at the moment. Was there anything from your history degree that sort of helped confirm to you that you wanted to go down the sort of writing and investigative journalism route? Or was it more about what you were doing with Backbench, that sort of stuff in your personal time, that was the thing that helped shape your career plans?
I think it was definitely the degree as well. I think it in many ways substantiated my passion for politics and writing and honed my skills on that front. I think as well, I think actually doing a history degree in many ways was perfect preparation for being an investigative journalist, because the process of doing history is digging stuff up about the past that other people haven't spotted yet. And all I'm doing as an investigative journalist is doing that in the present day. So actually it's a remarkably similar skill set. You know, if you said it to people, they won't realize it, but it's helped me in a lot of ways. In my future career, on top of, you know, just basic political knowledge and curiosity for the world and that sort of breadth of understanding of past political circumstances that really informs the work that you do in the present day.
So you've mentioned quite a lot of skills there with research, curiosity, the sort of political understanding. Are there any other kind of more sort of personal strengths or qualities you'd say you need to have to be sort of not just successful, but happy having a career as a writer and investigative journalist?
Well, that's a really good question. Although it's not necessarily the healthiest quality at times, I think I've definitely benefited from being an obsessive of like, especially being an investigative journalist, you can go through a constant process, like I said earlier, of being rebutted, of trying to sniff out a story, going down a particular rabbit hole, and not finding anything there. And you've got to really be laser focused and like I say, obsessive about getting to the bottom of the story and not giving it up. And so that, like I say, that's not necessarily, you know, a great quality at times, because being obsessive can also cause you to become too obsessed and to try, you know, a big thing for me is about finding that balance in life that distracts you from the latest investigative project, because it can become all consuming. And journalism is immensely competitive, and you know, everybody's competing for stories, everybody wants to get the scoop, everybody wants to get thousands of Twitter followers, etc. And it can be quite an overwhelming experience, especially when the industry as it currently is and as it has been for the whole of time is dominated by people from certain social backgrounds. So I'd say you've got to be robust as well. Going down to do work experience in London after graduating, you know, I've been to London less than, you know, half a dozen times by the time I spent 2 weeks down in New Broadcasting House, literally W1A, you know, the epicenter of Regent Street in the heart of central London, and was working on the Victoria Derbyshire programme, which sadly doesn't exist anymore, but is a flagship current affairs TV programme. And so I think you've got to be robust enough to cope with those quite different, challenging, changing circumstances. And, you know, the ability to speak to people is essential as a journalist. You know, you've got to be able to often get people to tell you things that when you first get on the phone with them, they're not quite that keen to say. And there are lots of ethical considerations in journalism. You know, you've got to people who've experienced, you know, you're telling the stories of people who often have experienced horrific things. And you've got to balance the benefit to the world of getting their story out, but also not pressuring that person too much if they don't want to tell their story. And, you know, that's a challenging thing as well. I think you've got to be quite morally conscious of what you're trying to achieve by going into the profession and not letting your spirit of competitiveness, of you trying to win this game, you've not got to let that override those ethical considerations that we all should have as a journalist in terms of treating the facts properly and treating the people who you're speaking to with compassion and kindness, a basic desire not to mislead people and to expose wrongdoing rather than to punish the little guy. Or at least that's my attitude on how journalism should be conducted. I'm sure that other people at other publications may disagree.
I guess that personal integrity really comes into it there, though, because you, if you're on your own investigating a story, you haven't got someone double checking that you're being fair and kind to somebody, that you're not putting them under pressure to speak and making them sort of do something they don't want to do. It is down to you making that moral judgment in that moment. And as you're hinting, I'm sure there are people who don't have that same level of integrity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you can sound quite pious about it. You know, I have integrity and other people don't. I actually think that even at publications that you think, you know, perhaps don't have the best ethics, I'd say the majority of journalists, particularly junior journalists who work there, have gone into the industry for the right reasons and are using that experience as a stepping stone to something else and to, you know, deliver the sort of journalism that they imagined when they first went into the industry. I think the problem is that once you get within those organisations, they're often the best paying, the opportunities elsewhere are quite limited, and so you can end up stuck there, which is sad. And, you know, that's really a call for anybody who believes that journalism with integrity should be supported in modern Britain to go and do it, because that's the only way that we're going to get those people out of those publications and into you know, into better news organizations. But yeah, I mean, I think fundamentally my sense of integrity and, you know, hopeful, you know, the moral clarity that I try to bring to my journalism has actually made me a really, you know, a good one. Unfortunately, I think there's a deficit of journalists who've exposed really high level wrongdoing over, you know, recent years. And I've kind of seen a gap there, and I've filled it. And fortunately, it's conformed to, you know, the sort of society that I think that we should be trying to create.
So for you personally, then, what would you say is the thing that you really love about the job? And what's the worst bit of the job?
I think the best thing is that rush of getting a store, like getting a really groundbreaking story out there. You know, whether that's interviewing someone about something shocking or really important that hasn't been published before, or whether it's, you know, finding something out about a politician or a business. Yeah, that moment when the publish button is hit and you see it online, I think that's a really validating moment. The worst thing about it, honestly, I enjoy pretty much all of it. I can't think of much that I don't like. I guess the thing is, it's not actually the process of navigating the job. It's part of it is the relentlessness of it, particularly if you work in news organisations, so daily news organisations, as I have in the past, and particularly small ones where they're not particularly well resourced, is that, you know, there's no let up. You're publishing, you know, you're writing up to, you know, in some cases, 10, 20 stories a day if you're working for some publications. You're absolutely shattered by 7, 8 o'clock, and then you've got to do it all again 8 o'clock the following day. And that can really be draining. That can be incredibly draining. And staying on top of all the bad news in the world, which unfortunately is the main stuff that people want to read about. People, you know, what bleeds leads is the famous phrase from the media industry, and, you know, that holds true even today. So you've got to absorb a lot of bad news and be able to cope with that emotional pressure. But then, you know, just the basic thing of trying to navigate this industry and trying to, like, put food on the table while, you know, doing a job that you really enjoy, not being able to give it up, that's quite tough in current circumstances as well. But, you know, I've been pretty fortunate, especially in recent years.
For students or recent grads who are thinking about, you know, hope maybe pursuing this as a career, what do you think are the sort of key challenges or issues that are kind of coming up in the future that is worth them being aware of, or perhaps researching a little bit more, having a think about if it's something that they want to be working with?
it's something that has relevance to what I've done in the recent past, actually, is that I think don't underestimate the extent to which social media has completely revolutionized journalism. I mean, it's revolutionized. The digital world has revolutionized most things, but particularly in journalism. So like, say like 20, 30 years ago, I don't think there would have been a chance of me getting into journalism and doing the things that I've done. You know, this upper working class lad from the countryside in Huddersfield with no connections to any journalist, any politician. I was just able to create this platform for free, network with a load of people from across the country who were interested in a similar position to me and wanted to write about politics because of the opportunities that social media provided me. And I'd say my big recommendation still is for young people to harness that. For students to harness that. And obviously the particular forms that takes are changing all the time. So I wouldn't, in current circumstances, I wouldn't necessarily recommend Twitter, which was the route that I used. You know, it's very powerful in terms of getting you seen by people in the media. And that's been a benefit. But, you know, the likes of TikTok is a huge platform. And I've seen many people who you wouldn't call traditional political commentators become basically TikTok commentators on politics and gain tens of thousands of followers in a way that, you know, I don't have the aptitude to master now, but I'm sure plenty of people who, you know, are studying at York at the minute will have those skills. And they are not skills that are held widely in media outlets around the country, even though they recognize that, like, the likes of TikTok, Instagram, new media platforms are ways that they can promote their journalism. So I'd say really try and tap into that clamour from new news organisations to harness these new technologies.
That's really interesting. And the idea that actually younger people could already bring something really valuable and a different experience to other colleagues already working in the industry. That's an interesting way to flip the power dynamic there as well.
Yeah, and I think actually lots of, not just in terms of actually using the technology itself, but writing about the trends that are happening on those platforms, there is a massive demand for it in broadcasters, in newspapers. Often that's where you'll get your opportunities because an editor will turn to a young person and say, you know, write about what's going on TikTok. And, you know, that might get you your first byline, your first on-air camera appearance. And then, you know, once you've done that, once you get your name in print or your face on telly, then it can kind of snowball from there. So I'd say, yeah, definitely lean into that.
Amazing. Well, for more info about the careers we've mentioned today, I'm going to add some relevant links to the episode description and a link to the full transcript of today's show. But Sam, thanks so much for taking the time to do this. Really, really fascinating insight into what your world involves. So thank you. I really appreciate it. I know a lot of students will be really interested to hear this. So thanks.
No, that's an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us this week on What Do You Actually Do? This episode was hosted by me, Kate Morris, edited by Stephen Furlong, and produced by both of us. If you love this podcast, spread the word and follow us. Are you eager to get more tips? Follow University of York Careers and Placements on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. All useful links are in this episode's description. This has been produced at the University of York Careers and Placements. For more information, visit york.ac.uk/careers.